New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is Manly and Marie Hall, a metaphysical romance. My guest is Ronnie Pontiac, who worked as Manly P. Hall's research assistant, screener, and designated substitute lecturer for 7 years. He has produced award-winning documentaries and has written articles for esoteric magazines. He is author of American Metaphysical Religion, Esoteric and Mystical Traditions of the New World. He is co-author with his wife Tamara Lucid of The Magic of the Orphic Hymns, a new translation for the modern mystic. Ronnie lives in Los Angeles. And now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Ronnie. It's good to be with you once again.
As always, I'm honored and delighted to be here, Jeffrey.
Well, this is going to be a very heartfelt conversation, I think, because of the close relationship that you and your wife had with Manly Hall and his second wife, Marie.
Yes, I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to speak about them and about what we observed about their relationship.
You actually spent a lot of time with them in relatively intimate circumstances in their home, for example.
Yes, they were very kind to us. Very early on when I started to work for him, Manly Hall invited me to bring Tamara to dinner at their house. And it was a really lovely occasion. They were so sweet and amazing to be around. And the friendship quickly developed. They both really loved Tamara, and they wanted to encourage me. And so they started to invite us to have dinner with them at their favorite restaurant, Michael's, as well as at home. And pretty quickly, they told us that we could come over whenever we wanted without even calling, which was something that we did not do.
But it's wonderful that they would extend that invitation. It shows how open they were to you.
Yeah, it was amazing. We were rather stunned by how generous they were and hospitable.
The irony of doing a video interview like this about Manly Hall is that half of our viewers will be very familiar with his work and will have read The Secret Teachings and America's Secret Destiny and some of his other classic books, and the other half of the viewers may have no idea who he is. So I need to try to balance what we say for both of these audiences.
Well, we're talking about somebody who was born in 1901 and who died in 1990. So his life touched every decade in the 20th century. Marie was just born 3 years after him, and she would live all the way into the 21st century. And as far as who he was, I like to call him the Kobe Bryant of the self-reliant. Because he had a 70-year career. He wrote over 150 books and pamphlets, and he filled decades of his monthly journals with articles. He delivered more than 8,000 lectures, so his statistics are just simply off the charts. And he has left so much material that is inspiring to people. I mean, even today on YouTube, he has many videos with hundreds of thousands and a few videos with millions of views. And most people's comments are about how much his point of view helps them in their lives. So he was a prolific author. In the beginning, it's really a fascinating story because, you know, he comes out of nowhere. He's born in Canada. His father abandons the family very early on, and his mother decides that she can't handle it, and she goes off to be a chiropractic healer for gold miners in Alaska. His grandmother raises him, and his grandmother is deeply into theosophy and into this wave of interest in metaphysics that had been going on in America, especially since the 1890s. And so she was a tremendous influence on him. And she brought him to America when he was 4, and they lived in a bunch of different areas. He writes about experiences that he had with an indigenous shaman and experiences he had, on the other hand, in New York City. And eventually, when he reaches age 18 in 1919, she dies. He's working as a file clerk in a Wall Street office, and he can't stand it. He wants to have more meaning in life. He doesn't appreciate the conformity, and he decides to go find his mom, who has retreated to the warm weather of Los Angeles by then. And he's blown away by what he finds here. He told me that the sidewalks were still wooden in most of Los Angeles when he first got here. And he loved to go down to the beach in Santa Monica. And there were like fortune tellers who had these little houses that were basically right on the beach. And there were flowers growing, fields of them right up to the beach. And there was fun houses already and such. And he liked to hang out there and listen to people lecturing and people reading cards. And it all fascinated him as he saw it in action. And he met a guy that would give talks out there, lectures, and who encouraged him to give a talk. And it turned out that he had this incredible skill and already had a ton of knowledge from reading his grandmother's books. And so in this hothouse climate where the Theosophical Society and so many others had been putting up buildings and libraries and dedicating this city to Madame Blavatsky's dream that Southern California would be the site of the birth of the new root race, as she would put it, and that this was going to be, and they were already throwing around the term New Age, and it was all in this Los Angeles basin especially. So he really was in the right place at the right time. And as his skills became apparent over the next several years as a lecturer, and he put out some books, small books, he got a following of people both humble and wealthy and powerful, and even movie stars here and there, and a lot of donations and support for him to go abroad and acquire manuscripts and all kinds of treasures of esoteric history. With the help of his main benefactors, who were a couple of oil heiresses. And he was an unusual kind of guru figure in his youth, because he was really handsome, you know, tall guy with deep blue eyes and really articulate. But he claims, and I kind of believe him, that he believed in celibacy at the time, because he thought that any kind of a physical relationship would detract from the focus of his spiritual disciplines and studies. And so now I did hear a rumor later from somebody that I believe was telling the truth, who was a carnival dancer at one time. And she said that when she was around and he was around, which was, I think, later on, that he was known for having romantic trysts with attractive fans in Santa Barbara and other places. But I haven't really run into that story anywhere else, so I'm not sure that there's any truth to it. While he is you know, developing into this character in metaphysics, who's being hailed by the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians of Max Heindel's group as this great new teacher, he gets involved with his secretary, who he hires when they're both about 24, 25. Her name was Faye B. de Raven. And she was very beautiful. She looked like a silent film actress, but she was sickly. She had nervous disorders. She was ambitious and competitive. She wanted to write her own book. But she was a great help to him. I mean, she was his secretary. And she helped him put the big book together, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, perhaps more than anyone else had, even though there was a community of people that were involved in helping him to realize that vision. But she apparently had bad feelings about him not crediting her in some way, or at least maybe in the dedication, saying something about her. And so the book was a huge hit. It's still the book that everybody usually meets him through. There's over 1 million copies in print. And it's now just called The Secret Teachings of All Ages. But back then it had this really long, impressive name. And it was a beautiful, oversized volume that was really a masterpiece of the printing art in a limited edition. It made him into this very popular lecturer. He was suddenly hailed as this worldwide expert on everything esoteric, even though he'd never taken a class in college ever. And as he became so popular, he was offered a lot of money to go out and lecture and to tour as a lecturer. So at first, you know, her life with him was kind of glamorous because they were living in a really beautiful house that one of his followers owned. And then they went into a couple smaller apartments, but then they were offered this incredible opportunity to live in the Frank Lloyd Wright house, the Ennis house, that you can see in Blade Runner and in House on Haunted Hill. And it was empty at the time, and this person who owned it would allow people whom he admired to live rent-free there so they could pursue their projects. And so he offered this to Manly Hall and to Faye, and they went there and they had these glamorous parties. They were this glamorous couple, you know, this alchemical marriage that would host psychics and swamis and movie stars and exotic music on this place that, you know, this outside patio that looked out over the whole city, very dramatic setting in this Mayan kind of ruin looking dark shadowy building. And it must have been very impressive altogether, and they must have had some great times. But by 1940 in there, and we're jumping forward a bit, they were really tired of dealing with it because it was a very hard place to live in. The heat didn't really work. There were terrible problems with water leakage, and the water leaks would cause bees to gather, and there would be swarms of bees flying around in spring. And they finally gave up and moved into a very humble apartment, and they continued to live this lifestyle where he would go off and be adored and idolized as this genius, and she was basically alone and became sicker and became more, I mean, she deteriorated mentally. Eventually she would commit suicide, blaming insomnia and heartbreak. And he had been in his lectures referring to divorce more and more, and you could see what was going on there was not going well. And he was devastated by that, and of course. And he eventually had all mention of her redacted from all the PRS records. And she was never, ever mentioned. And the entire time that Tamara and I were there for 7 years, friends with them, we never once heard that he had a first wife. And we had no idea that had happened to her. So obviously this was something about which he felt a deep sense of regret and didn't want any reminders of. During that time, Marie was starting to hang around. And Marie's story is a whole nother thing, because she's German during World War I. And so there were rumors that she had been attacked as a child during the war. She would have been something like 11 or 12 years old. We know that her family's income was devastated. And so she was desperate to come to America and came here as something of an indentured servant. She had to work for free wrangling some wealthy person's child in order to pay off the boat ticket. And she took other jobs and really adjusted to American life fairly quickly and got an offer to run the office of a Long Island yacht club. And so she was very excited about that. But what she didn't realize was that the kind of cruelty that can happen in war also can happen in peacetime. And while she was there, maybe possibly because she was German and there were still strong feelings about Germans, she was attacked by a group of men and assaulted and left lying there bleeding in on the ground. And even worse, she became pregnant from the assaults. And so someone that she knew in the yacht club stepped up to try and help her and arranged for her to have an abortion. And she kind of freaked out. And she came to L.A. to try to be a Hollywood star, just kind of out of nowhere. And she had parts as an extra in about 15 movies. I mean, she was a really beautiful woman and very charming and intelligent. But after that experience and the experience of Los Angeles, she kind of surrendered, in a sense, to another fate. And she went back and married the guy who had arranged the abortion and had a couple kids with him and was trying to be a wife and mother. But she had this urge, she wanted to save the world. There's no other way to describe it. She wanted revelations. She wanted the wisdom of all the cosmos. And here she was trying to make lunch for kids and get them to school on time. She says that she was sitting on a park bench in New York after she'd gone out shopping for the family. And she was approached by a handsome stranger, she says, who she later believed was an emissary of a secret society, because she believed that in her life, several times, many times, people appeared and just kind of gave her things or directed her in the right way. And she always thought that they were being sent there to do that, to keep her going on her mission. And this guy said that she should take the subway and go see a lecture that was going on at the Pythian Temple. And she decided, yeah, why not? And she went. She had nothing to do anyway. And she found a balcony seat. It had already started. And there was Manly Hall. And she said he was spellbinding, matinee idol looks, incredible speaking skills. And he was showing slides of the school that he intended to build in a place called Las Feliz, California. And that was going to be PRS. And so she wanted her kids to go to that school. And that's what started it all. She spent several years studying his work and studying metaphysics after that lecture. She said that they actually encountered each other because she wanted to go up to him and tell him, I'm going to send my kids to your school. But there was this big crowd. And she tried to push her way through. And she says that he noticed her. Big tall guy, seeing this little short 5'2" woman trying to get through the crowd. And he looked at her across a few yards and he said, young lady, you should be studying metaphysics. And so she did. And she got deep into it and started to put together this kind of mission for saving the soul of America that she was basing out of things like the Francis Bacon Shakespeare controversy. And the idea that the Rosicrucians were really behind the founding of America, which is also catnip for Manly Hall.
Well, he wrote The Secret Destiny of America, so I would imagine that some of her ideas were derived from his work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were really a team. And it's funny because most of the people that knew them and were manly people, which was most of the people, they all felt that this was a bad marriage. They often compared her to the wife of Socrates, and that, I've even seen people say, well, if Manly Hall was so smart and such an enlightened person, why did he marry such a crazy person who tortured him and, had no value? They used to call her Mad Marie at PRS. That's how I first heard about her. They would mention Mad Marie under breath. And I saw this little shelf in the gift store that was like way in the back. And it looked like if you went to sort of a straight bookstore or a nice gift shop, and then in the back you found a bunch of Black Panther pamphlets or something that somebody had put there, and that's the only place they were allowed. And that's her pamphlets were like these little revolutionary, her books were these revolutionary items that were in a bottom shelf in the back, and with these complicated titles. But I tell you, they were so involved in each other's work. they were so interested in this particular aspect of Bacon's great instauration, right? The idea of bringing education to everyone and of opening up and liberating the sciences and opening up the leadership of the world to be guided by science and by a new kind of higher awareness. And they both have this sense of secret societies guiding America's destiny and such. So I think it must have been, here's a really interesting thing. At the time, right before Faye, his first wife, commits suicide, he gets sick. It's 1940 and he suffers from some kind of a thyroid disorder. And at the time they didn't really have good allopathic options and none of his homeopathic efforts were working. And they did something pretty radical, which put him in the position of struggling with obesity all his life. And it was the first serious health problem that he had confronted. And that life that they'd been living in that Frank Lloyd Wright house with the glamorous parties, it turned into something really different for both of them. And so at this time, you know, this was around the same period, just before he got sick, and around the time that their marriage was failing, Marie's having these adventures. She is, you know, first she shows up in LA because she's convinced her husband that they've got to raise the kids there so they can go to PRS school. And then she starts showing up at the library and asking Manley for permission to look at his 17th century books, because she's looking there for information about the Bruton Vault and this stuff that she had learned about from somebody else at the library who claimed that he had found a cipher in the Shakespeare writings and in other Elizabethan writings that revealed that there was gold hidden in Virginia. But her research, based on his, went further and said, no, it's not just that. It's also that the original Shakespeare manuscripts in the hand of Bacon are in there. And all the Rosicrucian plans for America that were implemented over the centuries to prove that they were planned by Bacon and his group of angelically inspired geniuses. And so she felt that this was like this heritage that was supposed to come to the light to save America and awaken it as it understood what its true origin was and therefore what its true destiny was. And that it was indeed her mission to go dig this thing up. And she's telling Manly Hall this stuff, and he's sitting in this cramped little office. He's been giving lectures for a while now. The big book was a huge success 10 years ago. His wife is depressed and sickly. He's not feeling well. He doesn't yet know quite what's wrong, but something is seriously off. And here comes Marie, this Indiana Jones of metaphysics, with this plan to go to Virginia and dig up a grave and find these wonders that Bacon has left for everyone right before the World War. So she went and did it. She actually goes to Williamsburg, and she's so persuasive that she convinces the Vestry and the Rockefeller Trust, who are the ones who are actually restoring Williamsburg, and even the local government, that she should be allowed to dig at this particular site based on these various ciphers and such. And it's a big deal. It's in the news. And an amusing side note here is that about then, a young K. Paul Johnson, who was going to be one of the great pioneers of American metaphysical religious studies in academia, who wrote important books about Madame Blavatsky's masters and about Edgar Cayce. He was studying then. He was a young student, and he said that she was terrifying to him and to many other people who were locals, because here was this woman with a strong German accent just before World War II began. The Nazis were in full bloom, and she's talking about conspiracies and how America isn't what America thought it was, and Shakespeare didn't write the plays, and she's going to dig up this grave and prove that history is all wrong. And they just found it alarming. But yet she was allowed to do this. They found nothing. They even put sounding poles down even deeper than they dug, and they found nothing. Ever resourceful, Marie starts looking around at the, as she explained to me, the graves that were from that era that were the nearest by, because they seemed to be a place where you would put messages if there had been maybe a change of plans, because maybe the books that she had used to find this message had actually been published, you know, a couple hundred years ago, 300 years ago. So the things had changed. They had done things differently. And sure enough, she found these ciphers in some of the graves. And now she had a new place to dig. And to my amazement, they allowed her to dig, and they dug again. And this time they hit something. And what they hit was a wooden box with kind of leather and nails. And she thought, here we go. This is it. They said it was a coffin. And they said, no, we got to stop. We can't just be digging around in here. This is like sacred ground for American history. And everything was over, they thought. She got in touch with somebody who was one of the very earliest geophysical engineers and who could do a survey underground using his electronic gear. So he came out and he claimed to find something, and it could be the copper cylinders because it was a large shape that could contain something like that.
Copper cylinders, what are they?
The copper cylinders, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that all the stuff would be contained in the copper cylinders, the original Shakespeare plays, all the amazing Baconiana associated with the establishment of America and with subsequent history as planned by the Rosicrucians would all be preserved in these copper cylinders that would be hidden in this vault.
Before we go too much further, Ronnie, I think it would be useful if we say a few things about Francis Bacon himself and the role that he plays in all of this.
Absolutely. So, of course, we have Francis Bacon as we see him in history, which is this incredibly talented intellectual who had all sorts of brilliant ideas about improving government and opening up science. And he's widely credited for being the moving force behind the creation of the Royal Society, which was, in a sense, the culmination of the Rosicrucian dream of what they called the Invisible College, or the College of Light, where all these great minds, they would come together and they would share the results of their experiments and of their discoveries, and this would forward the human race by everyone being able to share their brilliance. And so he did all kinds of things. I mean, he wrote plays for Princess Elizabeth and Frederick Palatine's marriage. He wrote kind of satires. He wrote utopias, the famously New Atlantis. And many people think that New Atlantis was a blueprint for America, and that he was a moving force in the idea that America should be colonized, and should be colonized as an experiment in a new approach to an open mind, and not just another place where churches would be dominant. Now, there's another Francis Bacon that is sort of the Francis Bacon of mythology. On the one hand, you've got people like Rudolf Steiner, highly respected, who didn't really believe that Francis Bacon was a good guy. He thought that Francis Bacon came from the Ahrimanic school and was a materialist who had unleashed the terrors of modern science on the world through his materialism. On the other hand, there's a long tradition of people, and really wonderful books were published. They're just, at the very least, they're a Borgesian joy of mixed fiction and truth, that are all about the fact, supposedly, that Bacon wrote the Shakespeare plays. And so the plays are examined for ciphers and for events in Bacon's life, and all kinds of messages are found, and there's still societies today that are pursuing this. And Bacon's not the only one, by the way, who has been credited for writing the Shakespeare plays. He's like everybody but poor William, has been given credit in the esoteric community. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that I remember Manly Hall showing me two little bits of what they considered evidence, but they are certainly strange anomalies that need to be explained. I mean, maybe they're just errors, but the one was, I believe, in an early copy in the PRS library of The Anatomy of Melancholy by Burton, which is an absolutely wonderful book, highly recommended to anyone. And in that, there was a little footnote that's referred to, I believe it was Francis Rosycross. And so this was taken to be an indication that Francis Bacon was involved with the Rosicrucians. And then there was another one in another book that was Johann Valentin André Lord Verulam. Now, the only Lord Verulam was Francis Bacon. And so here again, Johann Valentin André, alleged author of the Rosicrucian manifestos, or at least co-author, is now being identified with Francis Bacon. And I've even seen the argument that Francis Bacon was André, that Francis Bacon was one of these invisible Rosicrucian masters, in a sense, or people that could live 100 or 200 years or enter, you know, the body at will. And so after Francis Bacon, quote unquote, died, then he goes off to be Johann Valentin André, which was a pretty tricky thing because André seemed to have only been about 16 to 18 years old when he worked on the manifestos. But for someone who could morph their body, that wouldn't be strange. And so these beliefs were there in the Theosophical Society at PRS among the Rosicrucians. And so Francis Bacon by them is seen as possibly being Father CRC, the founder of the Rosicrucians, the person who really liberated the world of esoterica.
So we have some vastly different opinions of Bacon.
Both kinds.
And I gather Marie felt that she was able to decipher the various cryptic codes that Bacon was known for.
Yes, absolutely. She, with the help of this guy Cunningham, and she made a lot out of that name, you know, Cunningham, speaking of Bacon. And she used to call Manly Hall reincarnated Francis Bacon and say that's why he was such a ham. She believed she had all the gossip, that the Shakespeare plays were talking about actual events in the Elizabethan court, and they were thinly disguised in the plays. She had the plans for America, and she had these experiences. So I worked for Manly Hall for 7 years, and near the end of it, there was a point where she really wanted to get some work out. And she wanted me to work with her because when she would go off on her rants after dinner, not every time, but often, about politics and about her mission and what it meant to the world and what Bacon had done and what America was supposed to be and the need to liberate women and how mothers would be the ones who would rise up someday and create a more evolved society. And she'd get all worked up, and Tamara would have a horrible headache, and I'd be following her, you know, and I would ask her questions that made her eyes light up because, well, we got it. Okay. So let's go another step. And one of the funny things was that Manly Hall would always look like he was asleep. And then she'd say something like, Manly, what date was that? He'd be like, 1849, like right off the bat. It was very impressive. And so, but because of those interactions, she thought that I was the right assistant and I'd proven myself with him. So she actually offered to pay me a pretty good paycheck to do it. And I asked him and he encouraged me. He said, not only that, but get to know her work and let me know what she's talking about and let everybody know, like, what is this about? You know, you can translate what she's having such a hard time getting across. And so I worked with her for a while, and we had these long question and answer sessions where I tried to gain enough understanding of her work to help her to present it and to get it out there. And she would have experiences like Lincoln would, you know, manifest in her room when she was stuck, you know, in somewhere with something that she was trying to accomplish. And she would talk to Lincoln about it. And she would tell me this. And so I went back to him and I said, you know, she's talking to Lincoln, right? And he said, yeah. You know, he said she's always seen spirits and, you know, sometimes they talk to her. And I said, okay. You know, okay, so it's okay. And he said, well, he said, you know, William Blake used to see the angels that he painted. And I was like, yeah. You know, so I went back and I said, what did Lincoln say? And so she would explain to me the insight that she gained from her consultation with Lincoln. And now by the time I got there, you know, they were in their 80s and they were pretty quiet. Now, before that, she was so into this, Jeffrey. I mean, it was, she comes back in like 38 and she's triumphant, right? Because they found it. You know, we did this electronic sound survey and there's something down there. And now we've got to do, and she talked about this when I knew her too, we have to raise the vox populi. We have to get the voice of the people. The people must rise up and demand that this be opened and that the heritage of America be given to the people and to the world. And she really believed, you know, that this could happen. And she wrote a book like Foundations on Earth, where she told the story of how she did this and what happened and talked to her readers saying, come on, we've all got to get together and start this movement to get this open. And some people got behind her and were into it. And so she had this one friend, Fred Cole, who was like her greatest fan. And he actually created, legislation that he submitted to Senator John F. Kennedy and to all the senators in Congress that was about using Congress to get that vault opened and to implement Francis Bacon's plan for America. One was called the World Peace Act of 1950, and the other was called the Leadership Emancipation Act of 1950. And then she goes after Hoover, right? Like the head of the FBI. And she's like writing letters to him and the president and saying, you know, this is, you've got to get behind this. And this is where America's going. And we need to get a movement, a populist movement. And they take notice of her, but they ignore her. And she eventually goes to Washington, D.C. in the 1950s. She actually travels to D.C. in late 1954 and shows up at FBI headquarters and demands to see Hoover. So they assign this FBI agent to speak with her, and she starts telling him, I mean, she goes way back. Like, she's telling the whole creation story. And she's talking about, you know, and then Francis Bacon and who he was and what I'm trying to do right now. But she's doing it for this FBI agent. And the FBI agent reported that she was charming and obviously very intelligent, but that she got so enthusiastic about what she was talking about that she forgot what she was talking about. So they decided she was no harm, but she had a file and a thick one. And they eventually labeled her a chronic nuisance. And I have to say, I agree 100% with Tamara that had she been born 40 years later or something, Marie probably would have been a riot girl in Olympia, Washington with her zines. Some of them would have had the same title, like Common Sense in the War Between the Sexes. And I think her band would have been called Chronic Nuisance.
Well, we should mention now, since you brought up your wife, Tamara, that she's known as a musician in this rather esoteric category of punk feminism, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, definitely. Riot Girl was it still exists to some degree in different places, but its golden age was in the 90s, and it was a movement that grew up underneath the protective wing of grunge and punk. Kurt Cobain supported it, for example, and it was really amazing. I got to play a lot of shows, Riot Girl shows, and it was all put together by the girls. It was completely outside the business, completely DIY independent. In some ways, it really reminded me of PRS because it was all these earnest people doing everything themselves and trying to save the world with this information by telling the truth and creating their own little zines and putting them out there. And I was often haunted by memories of Marie when I was out there seeing even a Riot Girl merch table and thinking how Foundations Unearthed or Common Sense and the War Against the Sexes would fit right on the merch table on the zine shelf. And there was that same earnest desire to have a more civilized world through culture.
Jumping around and going back to Francis Bacon for a minute, my mentor, Arthur Young, who was the inventor of the Bell helicopter and deeply into metaphysics and passionate about Shakespeare, he had a collection of original Shakespearean folios and would hold evenings at the Institute for the Study of Consciousness where they would read from the Shakespeare plays. And it was his opinion that the Bacon ciphers, when applied to the plays of Shakespeare, led to a whole new play. You would take excerpts from each of the different plays and put them together, and a new play emerged, and which he claimed to have unearthed. And this play revealed that Bacon was actually the illegitimate son of Queen Elizabeth.
That is so. I wonder if that was in some way connected to Marie too, because Marie also believed that and also said that she found it in the ciphers. So either whether it's independent work or mutual influence, we can see there was a stream going on. And I would wish that, what an amazing thing to experience, Jeffrey. I wish I could have been there to hear that. I really would like to know what those other plays are.
I never got to see that play, but Arthur Young told me that he thought it was better than any of the other Shakespearean plays. He was in tears reading it.
Wow. That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. So there's this myth of about Bacon. He was not only the founder of the Western scientific tradition, but an important player. One might even say something of a founder of the Western esoteric tradition.
Yes, exactly. And that this was a passion shared by both of them. So, for example, they first bonded, I believe, over these books, these 17th century books, like the Withers Emblem Book and other emblem books, and finding these messages from these courageous, secret kind of revolutionaries who are planning a better society and who are revolutionizing spirituality and the arts and being inspired by this. And I had, for example, at one point, I had proven my ability to choose books well. And when I would go out looking for books for myself, if I found things that I thought the library should have, I would come back to Manly Hall the next time I would see him for lunch and say, I think I found something that you guys should think about. And often they would acquire it. So Marie got wind of this, and she decided that Manly had to go out and get some exercise and not just live in his house and in his office. And so she decided we would have a weekend excursion to the bookstores of our choice. It was kind of funny because it wound up basically being a drive-through for him. Because for the most part, except for one store that was very accessible, he would come into the store, in that store, and sit down on a chair and then have books brought to him. But the other stores, because they had steps involved, he just sat in the car and they brought books out to the car.
Oh, my.
And it was so cool to see the two of them talking about the volumes and their knowledge of the books and which edition and who was behind it and telling each other an amusing story about it. And that was just so much fun. And also, of course, to see the booksellers' reactions to having the one and only Manly Hall sitting there in this old blue Buick, I think it was, waiting for them so that he could possibly acquire a gem for the library.
Well, one thing we didn't mention is that Manly Hall was famous, one might even say notorious, as a collector of esoteric books, the library in Los Angeles today, even of the Philosophical Research Society that he founded, still holds about 50,000 volumes.
Yeah, that's correct. It's, well, he, the whole story of PRS is really interesting, I think, because it starts out, at first, you know, he's just touring. He doesn't really have a base of operations except for this kind of mobile one, the Church of the People, which is mostly downtown LA. But he's even working out of people's houses at a certain point. But he has this plan that he was trying to sell in that original lecture where he met Marie. And so the thing really got going in 1935, where they purchased a property in 1934. It was the Great Depression. Land was cheap. He had generous donors who still had a lot of money. And these are the people who had sent him out there on these journeys that he took to Europe especially, but also to Asia, where he acquired all kinds of treasures, books and manuscripts, and this collection that would be the collection of the PRS. Eventually the cream of it went to the Getty Museum. But the whole thing began in 1935 with about 100 people standing in a field of wild mustard on the corner of Los Feliz and Griffith Park, just down the street from Griffith Park. And Manly Hall did this prayer for dedicating the place to the glory of God. And the beginning of it, it was just a small little place. It was like an office, and there was a place to do printing where they had a print press, and they had like a little shop and some storage space and not much to it, but they had grand plans. And they were working with this architect named Robert Stacy Judd, who's quite a character, who left some landmarks in Southern California. Most famous are probably PRS and the Aztec Hotel, which used to be a Route 66 landmark. And he really was into Mayan architecture. He went and studied Mayan architecture in Mexico. And there's this great photo of him where he's all dressed up in an ancient Mayan outfit with a big feather to it. And they had plans to build this really grandiose thing, and they really weren't able to do that. But for a while, a good while, all he really had was this small office. And he's got a printing press, and he's got a bindery. And it's this just the beginning. And supposedly in this small office, which also served for storage, he had this life-sized cat, a statue of the ancient Egyptian goddess Bast. And before he would leave to do lectures elsewhere in the city, he would always scratch the head of this little Bast figure as he was leaving. And I believe that he continued to do that all the way through, that was backstage at PRS in the auditorium when I was there. Because he'd always go there, he'd touch something. And I never really bothered to take a closer look at it. But I think that it was the cat goddess Bast.
It looks like you have a couple of cat images on the dresser behind you.
I do. I have a couple of Bast in his honor.
Yeah.
In honor of both of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So this was around in the 30s. He's got this small office, and then they're able to build it up. And in 1950, they are going to build a vault for the library and additional offices. And eventually, later in the 50s, they expand the library. And then eventually in the 60s, they build an auditorium. And the auditorium was going to be this really exotic, amazing thing. It would have been Stacy Judd's masterpiece, but the building code was just, no, there's no way you could build that thing. And so they built a more modest building, and he started this tradition, which was lecturing every Sunday at 11 a.m. for a dollar. He did it for 30 years. And became like this fixture, and his life completely changed from traveling musician, you know, except lecturer. And he'd say he loved to be out there because during the day he would visit all the curio shops and all the bookstores and get to meet everybody. And he did acquire treasures during those daytime jaunts around the cities he was visiting to lecture. And now he completely changed, and he just basically liked to be at home and be at PRS. And PRS did everything he needed it to do. But it took, you know, something like 34 years for it to be everything, to even have the auditorium for him. It was a slow process of building it. And so at, during those days, more and more bequests were given of beautiful objects, of great books and book collections. For example, Natasha Rambova, who was a friend of Manly Hall's, and who was around PRS, she was Rudolf Valentino's widow. She gave gold coins, these ancient gold and silver coins, to PRS when she passed away. And the oil heiress bequested a home that she had once owned to Manly Hall. And that's the first time that he ever owned a house, was by this bequest. And so right then is when he married Marie. Now, I return you to what I was saying about, you know, we must imagine, now Manly Hall's building this thing up, right? He's building PRS. He's still out there touring and lecturing at the same time. He has buried the loss of his wife. It's been about 9 years since she committed suicide. And Marie has been this firebrand, going to Washington, D.C. and FBI and letters from the president and all kinds of crazy things, very exciting, and talking to him with great passion about what she's discovered in these books. And by the early 1950s, he's presenting her. So there's a flyer, for example, that says, Manly P. Hall presents Marie Bauer Hall in a class of 12 interrelated lessons, Birth of the New Age and the Pattern of the Living Way. That's a really early use of New Age, 20 years before it became popular, probably inspired by the books of Alice Bailey, I'm thinking. But the lectures were on Monday nights at the Friday Morning Club, which was a feminist club that was founded by a suffragist. And so this is pretty feminist stuff for Manly Hall in the 1950s. And he's supporting Marie in her efforts to get out there. And maybe he learned something from Faye's frustrated ambitions. I don't know that he wanted to, he really cared for Marie and he wanted her to have the career and not have Faye's fate. But Marie was a very difficult lecturer because she was super impatient and she would get tangled up in words and would try to tell too much of the story. And the other thing was that she readily admitted that the trauma that she had suffered repeatedly in her life garbled her communications and her books. She said that she knew that parts of her books were practically incoherent because of her trauma and her inability to keep the communication from being garbled. So she wrote books with titles like Inquiry into the Nature of Space and of Life in Space, or The Christ Principle and the True Christianity to Be, or Autocracy, Democracy, Communism, A Study in Principles and Lawful Ways of Their Administration. Most of these books in the 60s and 70s. And they're filled with these hyper-hyphenated Germanic sentences. And yet, you know, there's some really brilliant ideas in there. And you can see, if you listen, so like I chose this little thing to read so you can get a flavor for Marie speak.
Good.
And I think this one, if everyone will listen carefully, you'll get what she's saying. And it's pretty amazing. But it's tough to pull it out of this long train of words. Quote, and she's talking here about unquote, we're talking about the spiritual path and why the soul has so many problems when it becomes embodied. So, quote, here is where the first major obstacle is encountered. The immortal soul mind, seeking to communicate the warm light of essential soul insight and essential truth understanding, must now project immortal love, life, and truth light from within the soul to reflected picturing by and through the quote-unquote mortal, imperfect, poorly conditioned, form-bound or brain-bound human mind mirror. It's really the mechanics of higher consciousness trying to communicate with a material body put into some pretty difficult language. But it's an insightful, mystical description of an actual experience. And she was also capable of saying things that were simple and beautiful. Like she said that really what is the meaning of your teaching, Marie? The meaning of my teaching is that we should love everyone and everything. That's what we're born to do, to love creation. And she said it better than that, but really,
that's my philosophy. I agree.
Yes, exactly. She also, this is another example for you. She describes the Space Mother, and I must mention the Space Mother. It was very important to Marie. So one of the things that we studied together was the Space Mother. And this was her concept of the reality behind all religions. And she believed that behind the God of the Bible, behind the God of the Indo-Aryans, behind all the father gods, behind the monotheistic God, was a goddess she called the Space Mother, who was the true creator of the universe. And that being a loving mother, the Space Mother, once she gave birth to the creator God, allowed him to believe that he was the creator and gave him the power of creation to further influence her creation. And then she allowed him to forget her so that he could be himself. And so, in that forgetting is the gift to all of us to have our lives where we can be our own people and learn and be sort of mini gods. But we are all fated, she believed, to remember the Space Mother. And the ultimate realization for the deity that thinks of himself as the world creator will be the remembering of this incredible gift of love that his mother has given him. And she compared this to the love of mothers for children. And their selflessness. And she said that this selfless love was going to be the second coming of Christ. It wasn't going to be Jesus in the sky or something like that. It was going to be the actual awakening of all human beings to this love, to this great selfless love that mothers personify. And she believed that mothers would be the ones who actually caused this to happen, who would stop war and stop the cruelty of starving children and such. And so this idea of the Space Mother was key to her whole philosophy and of this remembering. So there was almost an Orphic quality going on there. But here is her description of how this creation worked involving the Space Mother. Just one sentence. The Space Mother's life creatively energized subconsciously life-aware waking leads to life-creative propelling of space-permeating, formed, and manifested life-energy states. It's almost a way of saying that the whole world is the Space Mother's dreaming subconscious.
Now, you have a vast knowledge of metaphysics yourself. This sounds like a somewhat original teaching. I mean, there's a sort of a tantric element to it and maybe a Gnostic element to it, but it does seem kind of unique.
Yeah, very much so. It's a hybrid, but it has original features, including her. She had this amazing alphabet thing using the Roman numerals. And some alphabet stuff to show how soul becomes matter. And so very simply, I mean, she would be probably yelling at me from the astral, but there's the one, right? So there's the birth of the creativity in the material world. And then that becomes the two, which is the primal splitting of the other, just like in a cell that splits. And then there's the three, and she shows you how this eventually leads to this complexity that is able to contain the consciousness of a soul. And she also did these amazing, in fact, I'll show you one, these amazing diagrams. Just so they were huge. They were like the giant diagrams, and they looked like this, and there were many of them. Here's an example of one of her books, what they looked like.
What's the title?
This is Inquiry into the Nature of Space and of Life in Space. But you will find at the back the Bruton Vault and Francis Bacon.
That was her obsession.
Yes, very much so. That was definitely the center of the whole whatever was going on there. And I'd say that with no disparagement. She is somebody that I can imagine people studying in the future and discovering that she was a brilliant mystic. And she had this whole kind of new feminist mysticism, because one of the things about her was that she was so, like, she would get mad at him. And sometimes she could really, I mean, she could make him cry, you know, because she'd say terrible things to him about things along the line of, you know, all you do is regurgitate history. You don't have any original visions. I'm having a direct revelation, and you won't help me, but you help all these men. You know, it's typical, you know, men do this. You know, there have been so many women in the world in history that had so much to give, and men didn't let us have the opportunity, and you're just the same. All you want is idolatry, and those kind of speeches. And she called him a dust eater. And she said, you're the reincarnation of the snake from Eden, still crawling around in the dust of your books. And he was a very emotional, heartfelt Pisces, and he hated when she was unhappy, and especially when she was mad at him. And he tried to do everything he could, you know. But she also was suffering, no one knew at the time, from diabetes-related sugar spikes that certainly very much exasperated the problem and caused her to have these peaks of excitement and emotional turmoil. But he was so patient, you know, even when he was upset by her, as soon as she was okay and she was, you know, she'd come over and she'd pat him and start playing with his hair and he'd smile and it was over, you know. Mm-hmm. They had a very sweet relationship. I definitely want to get across to everyone, because again, if you study him or you read about him online, you normally hear about what a nightmare. They had a terrible marriage, an unhappy marriage. Now, I only got to see them for those 7 years, and I don't know what it was like before or after that, although he wasn't around much longer after. But when I was there, they were the most amazing octogenarian couple I ever met. They were so in love, and I don't mean like an old couple that have loved each other for a long time. I mean, they were like romantically in love. They made each other laugh all the time. They teased each other. They were in each other's corner. They counted on each other. They talked over everything together. Tamara and I are married because those two talked over and decided we should be married, and they picked the dates and decided to do it in their own backyard with Manly officiating. And that's, even though the alienation existed at PRS and everybody tried to make it seem like, well, he was running away to the office to get away from her, they didn't understand that she was a huge part of PRS, because whenever he had to make up his mind about things or he was contemplating new projects, she was always involved in his thinking process. And she was a such a source of life in his life. And not only that, but this is something I find really interesting, is that he starts out, he's really pushing the occult, you know, and he's really into the secret doctrine and Donnelly's Atlantis book and just all the classic stuff, Heindel Cosmogenesis or Rosicrucian Cosmogenesis, I think that's what it's called. And it's the gospel, right? I mean, there's the root races, those are real, that's what it is, there's no metaphor, this is the stuff. And he's talking about invisible initiates, and he later said to me that he regretted those days, and he regretted emphasizing those things so much. And he changes around World War II. Now, part of that, I think, is the loss of Faye. Part of it is that he sees, as he becomes so popular with the secret teachings, he starts to get a never-ending stream of desperate people coming to him for help. And I got to witness that as his screener alongside Tamara for a few years, and it was really a very sobering picture of the metaphysical community, as all these people who had run afoul of psychological problems or people who had abused them were trying to get some answers to their problems from Manly Hall. And they were coming in from every side of metaphysics. And he saw this. And I think that he even wrote that he felt that it wasn't any good to, well, for example, fulfill the dream of his youth to write a masterpiece about the genesis of the gods. How did the gods come to be? And it would be based on all the old, most ancient records about that. And he realized they didn't need that, that that wasn't going to help them, that what they really needed was ethics. They needed encouragement. They needed to learn how to live a better life. And so he started this process that I think he became very famous for, of distilling ancient wisdom in order to get these usable, practical pieces of advice for people. So he could tell you stories about Robert Flood or Zoroaster, but it would eventually apply to your life, and you would be able to live a better life because of this metaphysical principle that he was illustrating with the example that he gave. And at the same time, he is in a society where Blavatsky and others are being kind of attacked. People are saying, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't true here, and this isn't accurate history. And he obviously doesn't want to be dismissed with all of the late 19th century, early 20th century writers. And then there's the Marie influence, which I think is huge, because she told us that when she really became involved with him, because they knew each other for years before they got married, that he lived in this dark house, the one he inherited, with these big, thick blackout curtains and drawn against the daylight, and that he had a manservant who she described as being creepy and dwarfish, and he would wear black capes. And you see pictures of him from this era, and he looks creepy. He's kind of, well, like me, he's got the sunken cheeks and he's and the cheekbones, but he's got these big eyes. He's very serious expression. And that guy, you watch over the photographs now as he becomes involved with Manly Hall, with Marie, and he marries her, becomes this kindly, wholesome grandfather with a smile on his face, and wears completely different, just sort of comfortable clothes, nothing fancy, nothing ostentatiously occult ever. I mean, really, just middle class or even working class style, and he's a different person than he was before. And I think Marie is a huge part of it, because as she put it, she said, you know, I came into his life and I tore open those curtains and opened up the windows first thing in the morning and made sure that he had a good German breakfast every morning, because he would never eat breakfast. And her family, her sisters and her children and then her grandchildren became his family, because he didn't have any near family and they were his kids. And that family was so stable for him, and he loved it so much. He loved that her kids didn't think he was special at all, that he was grandpa. Why were people making this fuss? What a bunch of hypocrites. I mean, that's just my grandfather, and they're trying to get him to do all this crazy stuff. He's just a guy. And to him, that was wonderful. And so I think he got a lot out of Marie. And also, she was like his... You know, bringing up Kurt Cobain again, it was almost like Kurt and Courtney, because he was the Pisces, the Kurt, you know, he was this incredible artist and thinker and could turn the phrase, and people loved him, and he was just iconic, and everybody hated her, but she was outspoken and feminist, and she protected him fiercely, and he could... She would say the things that he wouldn't, right? And Marie was really somebody that was a lioness, you know, when she was protecting Manly Hall. And so that, and that too, they were good for each other, because consider that this woman who suffered so much trauma, that she felt under his influence, even before they were married, she regained herself. And she went on this crazy mission and dared to dig up a grave in the middle of the night and went to, you know, FBI headquarters. I mean, she showed this resilience and this courage. And we may say, well, that was all crazy. I mean, why was she doing those things? But she believed in herself and believed in her vision in a way that somebody who goes through that kind of trauma usually never finds again. And I think that speaks very deeply to what Manly Hall was teaching and also to his influence on her personally, because throughout their life together, you know, she was an inspiration to him and he was an inspiration to her.
Well, that's a wonderful thing in a marriage. I suppose when two people can inspire each other, you've got the makings of a successful relationship.
It reminds me of that Andre Malraux quote about a great marriage being a conversation that you don't want to ever stop. And that's what they had. They constantly were in that conversation. And it didn't matter if you were sitting at the dinner table. So, for example, since I mentioned it earlier, they often would go to eat at Michael's in the afternoon on Sundays after he gave his lecture. And the restaurant knew that he would be coming in. And he had a special table. And, of course, many of the people who had come to see him lecture knew that he would be there. So they also would come have lunch at Michael's. And they would file by his table to greet him and to say, oh, we drove all the way from Ohio. It's our first time seeing you. Or, oh, thank you, Manly Hall. You changed my life. It was really amazing to sit there with Tamara and listen and to all these testimonies of his influence. And he was so cute. He would just sit there and smile and say, oh, thank you very much. Not at all. And very, very bashful kind of about it. And Marie would lean over to Tamara and I and say, look at him. He loves it. And she was always like attacking him because he was so idolized and how much he liked it. And she actually said to Tamara, and I think this is amazing, when I was becoming popular because he chose me to be his substitute lecturer if he couldn't make a lecture, and I began to be seen as his possible successor because he asked me, for example, to work a funeral, two funerals for him when he couldn't make those. And so if I was popping up for funerals and I was the guy who replaced him for lectures and I was working with him every day, people thought, wow, okay, wait a minute, this must be the next guy. And so he, it was a hell of a thing to have that kind of a expectation foisted on you. And while I was struggling with this, Marie turned around to Tamara often, and she said, do not let him go down that trail. She said, do not let him go down that male idolatry star thing, metaphysical star. Don't do it. She said, it's too late for Manly, but you can save him. And she said, don't be quiet and just sit in the background. She said, you two need to find your own lives, and don't let him just repeat Manly's mistake. Because she felt that him accepting being glamorized, even though that was the price of his success and his fame, was something that had damaged their relationship and had damaged him and his own development. Now, what's interesting about that is that Tamara at that time, who was super quiet and very shy and was fairly comfortable just kind of being the wife, but was beginning to resent being ignored and treated badly by people who were ready to trample over her to get to me because they wanted to get to Manly Hall. And so she had no ambitions of any kind, really, except just be a good wife and live a good life and be kind to cats and plants. And the track that Manly Hall suggested that I take in life, after turning down a bunch of things that I came to him with when he asked Tamara and I to leave because he could see that he was going to be passing soon, that the place was going to suffer a lot of deaths and there would be a big power struggle and we were just kids, they couldn't handle it, was music. He said, go back to music, which was shocking to me because he didn't like music at that time. This was in the 80s, so it was all the crazy hair bands and everything. And because I went to music, Tamara, watching me unable to find musicians in the hair metal world, said, if these idiots can play guitar, this idiot can play guitar. And I'll be your guitar player. And I said, well, if you're going to learn to play guitar, I'll learn to play guitar too. little did I know that I had just actually given up my fate as a musician to the person who was going to wind up being the lead singer of the band that I would earn my asterisk in punk history with. And she emerged as this powerful presence in the Riot Grrrl movement, and has also produced some incredible social activist films about important things like the Standing Rock protests, which she associate produced and which was Emmy nominated, and just became this, you know, really wonderful person that blossomed out of her. And we often wondered, because they saw our charts and they decided we were going to marry. They even controlled what time we married. They fought over it, because on the day of our marriage, Manly Hall wanted us to marry with the ninth house sun, because that way we would be working with universities and higher learning and travel, and it seemed like a good life to him. But she insisted that we have the 10th house sun, because we were going to be bringing her work to the masses, and she wanted us to be as visible as possible. And so they actually had a tug of war over Tamara to try to get the sun where they each wanted it, and she won. And our marriage chart sun is in the 10th house. But the their whole approach to life was so much the invention of both of them. And so we went to like museums with them sometimes, and to walk with them through the museum, we were just observing, and their conversations as they knew so much about everything they were seeing. This was about Bodhisattva statues, and they knew that they would talk about the era and the legends and tell stories to each other, and we would just kind of spy on them the whole time and learn so much. So they had a very vital relationship that I think is a great example to people who want to have long-term relationships. They were able to overcome her anger and I think based on what happened to her in her life, not because of Manly Hall, because of society. She was a voice of a brilliant young woman who was frustrated by being assaulted and attacked and all her family's possessions taken from them, and one tragedy after another, not given the opportunity she deserved. And like so many women, carried a lot of anger about what happened to her in life. But he understood that, I believe, and he took it. You know, it's kind of like, I know when I went through Riot Grrrl and my musicians who were women were being changed by Riot Grrrl, and I took a lot of heat on behalf of mankind. And you do that, when you're doing that, you feel, you know, okay, yeah, take it out on me. I am a man. I did do those things before I understood what was going on. You go ahead, you know, and I feel he was like that. And so he understood that she wasn't personally attacking him, that she was expressing the other side of the human experience and the human predicament that he had never experienced, because he was this gorgeous, tall man, brilliant, who had basically from the beginning been greeted as the arrival of something special.
Well, what a wonderful story, Ronnie, of an era that is now past. I mean, Marie died almost 20 years ago, so we're a good generation behind all that they gave. And I guess it's fair to say, especially with his books, that Manly Hall's influence still continues today, even if Marie's is sort of eclipsed.
Oh, very much. She's obscure, although there was a book written, in case anybody's interested, called God as Mother by Victoria Jennings. And that is a good place to learn in depth about her teachings. And I still think that someday she may be discovered by feminist scholars in the esoteric field. She has got so many interesting things going on there. And then when you start to look at how things that he's doing and things that she's doing correspond. So, for example, one of the last books that he released was called, it was a re-release of New Atlantis Completed or something like that. And it was by R.H. And it was supposed to be the ending that Francis Bacon had never lived to finish for his New Atlantis. And it was a book from the 17th century. Why did he reprint it? I do not know. It was basically this kind of utopian vision that some say was for America. But I think that it was really because he and Marie were into that book at the moment, and they realized how rare it was. They wanted other people to be able to enjoy it, other Bacon scholars. And I remember how, by the way, like when a Bacon scholar would show up, there was a guy who came over from England who was a world authority on this Shakespeare controversy with Bacon. And they were just, it was like, I don't know, like you know, something you're into, like stamp collectors or Lakers fans or something. You know, it was just, they were of an ilk, and they understood each other, and they were excited to see each other. So it to me, they represented a very thrilling new way to live, because all the old couples that I had been around were so unproductive and so miserable, and usually attacking each other based on what they had done in their lives. And here was this couple that was passionate about knowledge, passionate about each other. Just the fact that she would tell him off because he wasn't being a good enough sage, you know, was really something amazing. And I also think when people say to me, you know, how could he have picked her and all the trouble she caused him? Or they say, how could he have been involved with a guy who may have killed him? Or how did he talk about the indigenous people and not realize that Manifest Destiny, which he praised, was a complete disaster? Well, of course, he did realize that, but he had that colonial mentality. But it was worth it because we got to have the future of civilization here. And I take it this way. If you expect perfection from him, or Marie, or any master, that's a great compliment. It means that they've moved you enough that you want them to be perfect, but they're not. They're just human beings. Manly Hall was just a guy. You know, once in a while, he liked to eat a cheeseburger. He wasn't a glutton. I never saw him eat a whole bunch of food. He was just a guy, a brilliant man with a great soul who did a lot of good for people. But he was never the perfect being, and he never claimed to be, and no one is. And so, but when people come at you with that, it's a compliment. It means that you've moved them enough that they want you to be even better. And she was a constant, that presence in his life, you know, a heckler living with him his whole life after he'd received nothing but praise. And people who are that successful, like we became friendly with this famous music business guy when we were in a band, Danny Goldberg. He was a manager of Nirvana, and he had worked with Led Zeppelin. And he'd always been a huge star in that field, in the music business, a really good guy. And when Tamara met him, she was his heckler. She was saying things like, oh God, aren't you the guy that thought up all that horrible chivalry stuff for Led Zeppelin that my brother used to torture me with? And he loved it, because when people have that kind of, you know, unmitigated success and they meet somebody who's willing to speak truth to power, I think that Marie had that for Manly, that like she was there going, oh no, that stuff doesn't work on me. And I think that he found that thrilling. And I also want to make sure, and we can continue or whatever you like, but I want to, before we do anything, I want to make sure this is in here, because people always ask me, what did he believe? And what did he practice, right? Those are the two questions. And his practice was constant meditation, he told me. It was just that he was in meditation, whatever he was doing. He tried to maintain that state of the golden flower that we talked about in our last wonderful discussion. And so anything he did was an opportunity to keep that meditative core centered while he was doing things that were challenging or distracting. But as far as his religious beliefs, people always say, well, what was he? You know, was he a Mason? Was he Christian? Was he? Because he quotes everybody. He's into everything. You can't be in every religion, can you? Well, he was. He was into every religion. But Tamara, in her book, which is a wonderful record of our experiences with them, if anybody's interested, it's called Making the Ordinary Extraordinary. And she ends her book with this, and I think this is the right way to explain him, because it's in his own words. And when I read this, when she found this, I said, that's him. And so I say to everybody, this is what the man believed. Quote, because of my reticence in discussing my own beliefs, I am frequently asked what religion I follow, what spiritual revelation has inspired my activities. The simple fact is that I sincerely believe that I'm serving the best of my ability, the dictates of my own conscience. My daily work is my discipline, and I'm making no effort to advance my own spiritual destiny. There seems to be no need to limit or restrict the normal actions of other human beings. My teacher has been the very public I am seeking to serve. Thousands of troubled people have sought my advice or assistance, and in each case, I have gained new and deeper insights into the workings of human thoughts and emotions. I know opinionated individuals who, instead of going their own way, came to the end to wish they had followed the advice they had formerly rejected. I have lectured in hospitals, prisons, Christian churches, and Jewish synagogues. I have baptized and christened the newborn, performed interreligious marriages which churches refused to solemnize. I've been called to the bedside of the sick, comforted the dying, and performed funerals and memorial services. These are the sources by which an understanding of life is enriched, and there is very little justification for antagonism, intolerance, or bigotry. End quote. To me, that's Manly Hall.
Beautifully put. What a saga. Thank you so much, Ronnie. It's been a joy to share this conversation with you and with the New Thinking Aloud audience.
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak about this. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And for those of you who are watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.